go bury myself, you know, in a bunch of work when my parents were in town. So I tried to get everything done in advance. So that's why the notes are so long. And there are also two appendices here that you should, I don't know if we're going to get to them quite yet today, but I just gave you everything at once so that you would have it as we started going through the studies. This morning, I also don't have a PowerPoint this morning. We've just been too busy with everything going on regarding Christmas and the holidays and trying to get everything in order that I didn't have time to make one. But I don't think it's going to hinder us too much. Lesson 51, and this is intended to be a part one of a two-part study. So what I think I'm going to do for the internet is wherever we stop, I'm going to break off and say that's part one, and then whatever we don't get to, I'm going to break off into part two. So the title of this morning's lesson is Darby on Trial, Debunking Attacks on the Preacher of Rapture. You know, before we get started, I just want to say that dispensational truth in general and the pre-tribulation rapture specifically are two, in my opinion, two of the most attacked, you know, doctrines that are out there. And as you'll see this morning, the people that want to attack the pre-tribulation rapture are basically saying that Darby is a liar. Okay? They're basically saying that all the chronology that we've studied over the last 4 weeks about looking into the when he understood things and how and why and so on, that all of that is all fabricated, that everybody involved in it, they were all, you know, old men reflecting back on what happened, and that, you know, they were all basically in cahoots together and fabricated that he understood this thing in 1827. Now, I said to you that he understood the basics of it in 1827, but from 1827 throughout the 1830s, he grew in his knowledge and his understanding of it. But the basic fundamental premises of it, he understood as early as 1827. Now, if you look at point number one in the introduction, it says the true origin of the truth of the pre-tribulation rapture, that is the pre-Daniel 70th week rapture, is in the New Testament. And this truth was recovered to the saints through the instrumentality of John Nelson Darby in 1827. Okay? Now, those who directly or by inference say that he lied about finding this in the Word of God fall into generally two classes. Okay? The first class are those who say that he was influenced by the Jesuits, Rivera and Lacunza. The second group are those who say it is from a demon-inspired woman in Edward Irving's church in 1832 or a visionary occult tongue-speaking Scots girl in 1830. Okay? So there are two major attacks of people that want to say that Darby lied about this, that it's all made up, that none of it's true, they didn't really understand in 1827, and that it really had other points of origin. And the first one is that the Jesuits were teaching this doctrine, then two Jesuits in particular who we're going to look at in the lesson, and then also the other one is that it came from either a tongue-speaking meeting in Edward Irving's church in 1832, and we talked about the tongues movement in Edward Irving's church last Sunday, and the other theory is that it came from a tongue-speaking Scottish girl in 1830. But the bottom line is that all of these charges, or both of these main charges, are being done to try to insinuate that Darby didn't understand what he says he understood when he says he understood it. Okay? Dave McPherson, author of The Rapture Plot, has done much to try to discredit the chronology and the testimony we have presented in this class. James Lloyd, author of The Rapture Cult, Dishonesty and Dispensationalism, stated the following. To put it bluntly, John Darby and certain key lieutenants blatantly lied concerning the source of their teaching. This set the tone for the dozens of thieves and robbers that would follow in Darby's footsteps. This completely dishonest practice of historical revisionism has been thoroughly examined in a series of books by several rapture experts, most notably a man named Dave McPherson. As a post-tribulationist, McPherson has invested 30-plus years in seeking to credit a Miss Margaret MacDonald of Port Glasgow, that's in Scotland, with having spoken of the pre-tribulation rapture in a revelation that she received. This lesson will be devoted to an examination of the major attacks upon the pre-tribulation rapture of the body of Christ. Okay? So you have people out there that they're flat out stating that Darby lied, that everybody involved with it lied, as to the true source of origin, and that it didn't come from the Word of God, and he didn't know it in 1827, but that he learned it from either Jesuit monks, or from a tongue-speaking girl in Edward Irving's church, or this girl in Margaret MacDonald in Scotland in 1830. Okay? So that's sort of just an introduction of the major things that we're going to be looking at here. Okay? Now, the second major point, was Franciscus de Rivera the source of the pre-trib rapture? The postmillennialist L. Botner, though he had found the root, thought that he had found the root of the dispensational movement, he stated the following. But while the dispensational movement did not gain popular recognition until the rise of the Plymouth Brethren, its real origin is traced to a Jesuit monk, Rivera, who lived in the early Reformation era. The standard Protestant interpretation at the time was that the Pope was the Antichrist, and that the sins of the Roman Catholic Church were set forth in the 17th chapter of the book of Revelation under the figure of a woman arrayed in purple and scarlet sitting upon a scarlet-colored beast. In defense of the Roman Catholic Church, the monk Rivera put forth the futurist interpretation of the book of Daniel. Now understand what this guy's saying here, okay? He's saying, and we've already seen this, that during the Protestant Reformation, the major Protestant interpretation of the book of Revelation was that the Pope was the Antichrist. Now, if you are a Jesuit monk, is that a problem? Yeah. So, this guy is saying that Rivera, as a Jesuit monk, came up with the futurist book, the futurist view of the book of Revelation, as an attempt to alleviate the papacy as being identified as what? The Antichrist. So he's just suggesting that dispensationalism or a futurist interpretation of the book of Revelation was put forward by this Jesuit monk in an attempt to alleviate the papacy of being identified as the Antichrist by the Protestants. Now, historicist Dr. H. Grattan Guinness, in his Approaching End of the Age, says, in its present form, it, referring to the futurist interpretation, may be said to have originated at the end of the 16th century with the Jesuit Rivera, who moved like Alcazar, a preterist, to relieve the papacy from the terrible stigma cast upon it by the Protestant interpretation, tried to do so by referring to these prophecies to the distant future instead of Alcazar to the distant past. Now, I kind of want to try to draw for you what this guy is saying. He's saying that in Revelation chapter 17, the main Protestant interpretation is that the Pope is who? The Antichrist. Okay? So he's saying, what Guinness is saying there is that there are two views here. That Rivera moved to a futurist view to allow for the Pope not to be what? The Antichrist. And then he also says that another guy named Alcazar, he moved it back and introduced preterism and said that everything in the book of Revelation had been fulfilled when? By 70 A.D. And he says that both the move of futurism, supposedly under Rivera, and also the articulation of preterism that everything was fulfilled in 70 A.D. are both attempts on the part of Jesuit monks to alleviate the Protestant teaching that the Pope was who? The Antichrist. Yeah.
What's the Antichrist? I mean, are they talking the future Pope was
going to
be Antichrist?
The papacy. The office of the papacy. Whoever was occupying the papal seat was the Antichrist, essentially, is what they're saying. So,
Reformers all believe that.
Yeah, Reformers basically all believe that. So what this guy's suggesting is that this Rivera guy invents the futurist interpretation, thereby putting the book of Revelation in the future to escape the Protestant teaching that the Pope is who? The Antichrist. And then he further suggests that another move, the move to preterism, that everything in the Bible, every prophecy, everything in the Bible was fulfilled by 70 AD, is another Jesuit monk to move it backward in time to escape the Protestant teaching that the Pope is what? The Antichrist. Okay? So there's two things going on here, and what these critics of Darby are saying is that Darby got his dispensational futurist interpretation of the book of Revelation from who? Rivera, a Jesuit, and therefore dispensationalism is fundamentally a Catholic what? Doctrine, and is therefore false. You following that? Okay. Next point, Eric C. Peters, author of The Antichrist and The Scarlet Woman, states the following. The method was invented by the Jesuit Rivera in 1585. Strangely, the modern futurist makes no mention of him in their writings. But be that as it may, to Rivera goes the credit for starting the futurist fire. It was first set adrift by Roman Catholic Rivera for the sole purpose of confusing Protestants. The truth of this statement cannot be denied, for copies of Rivera's original book are still in existence. Dr. Oswald Ellis, author of Prophecy in the Church, stated, the futurist interpretation is traced back to the Jesuit Rivera in 1580, whose aim was to disprove the claim of the Reformers that the Pope was the Antichrist. He adds that its acceptance by the brethren was not due, of course, to any objection to the Protestant interpretation as such, but to the fact that their literal interpretation of prophecy and their refusal to admit that predicted events were to precede the rapture made their acceptance of this system of interpretation inevitable. So, Darby is just inevitably following the consequences of his system of interpretation that leads him to follow the Jesuit monk Rivera in saying that the book of Revelation awaits a what? Future fulfillment. Now, before we move on, does everybody understand the charge here? Does everybody understand the charge, what they're saying, and what the implications are? So, Darby did not understand this during a period of convalescence, according to these men. He stole it from the Jesuit monk Rivera, reworked it, and put it out there, but it all dates back to this guy in the 1580s. Now, would that match what we've studied so far? That does not match the chronology of number one, A, Darby's personal correspondence, number two, the timeline of his written works that we went over, and number three, the testimony of his other friends and sometimes enemies in the ministry of when he understood these things. Okay? Next point, Heber states the following regarding these allegations. The truth is that in some measure Rivera returned to what some of the so-called apostolic fathers had taught. For there is no doubt that they looked for Antichrist and then Christ. As we have already seen in lesson 44, they were pre-tribulationists. For the loss of the rapture preceding the tribulation, along with the rise of crescency, were among the first departures. Following this, it was expected that Christ would set up a thousand-year reign on earth. It is a piece of a historicist myth-making taken up by others that the Jesuit Rivera started futurism. This is a sample of an attempt to stigmatize on the part of some opposed to the truth. Many anti-dispensationalists appear to be attempting to stigmatize futurism as Romanism and Jesuitism, and even some preterists do so, who seem to ignore that Jesuit Alcazar, who interpreted the book of Revelation in a preterist sense. The historicist interpretation, i.e., the Protestant interpretation, regarded the Pope as the principal Antichrist, and so when futurists regarded the Antichrist as a single future person. This was constructed as assisting the Romanists by relieving the Pope of this charge of being the Antichrist. Rivera produced a commentary on Revelation in which he viewed the Antichrist as a future individual. Likely this was an anti-Protestant move. But be that as it may, futurism had an earlier history.
Everybody understand what's going on there? Okay?
What Huebner is saying is that to some extent, Rivera was trying to alleviate the Protestant doctrine and claims that the Pope was the Antichrist, and he did it by moving things forward and saying that the Antichrist was a future individual that had not yet arrived.
Okay?
But to then say that he's the source of the futurist interpretation of the book of Revelation that Darby is discussing, and thereby the source of the pre-tribulation rapture, does not necessarily follow, and we'll go over the reasons why. Since early Christian writings held that the Antichrist was a future individual, Rivera was not the first to do so. Norman Coe, author of The Pursuit of the Millennium, informs his readers that others who preceded Rivera held such a view. Page 3 now. Moreover, the eschatological, had long associated the Jews with the Antichrist himself. Already in the 2nd and 3rd centuries, theologians were foretelling the Antichrist would be a Jew of the tribe of Dan, and this idea became such a commonplace one that in the Middle Ages it was accepted by scholastics such as St. Thomas Aquinas. Antichrist, it was held, would be born at Babylon, would grow up in Palestine, and would live with the Jews above all peoples. He would rebuild the temple for them and gather them together for their dispersion. The Jews, for their part, would be the most faithful followers of the Antichrist, accepting him as the Messiah who was to restore the nation. And the compendium of Antichrist lore, which Adso of Montanay Dur produced in the 10th century, and which remained the stock authority through the Middle Ages, Antichrist, while remaining a Jew of the tribe of Dan, has become still more uncanny and sinister. Now, what's that saying? Were there people, many people, before this Jesuit monk, including Catholics, that believed that the Antichrist was a future individual? Yeah. So the claim itself that this is a new teaching with this guy in the 1580s to escape the Protestant doctrine and interpretation of the Protestant reformers is itself not true. Because there were people all along and in the 10th century, including Aquinas himself, that viewed the Antichrist as a future Jewish individual of the tribe of Dan that would rebuild the temple. Okay? And that stuff is being taught for centuries before this guy shows up in the 1580s.
Yeah. Okay. Norm?
I had a question. I was listening to the Catholic radio. I mean, the Catholics are all millennial, is that right? But they still believe in the tribulation?
Yeah.
Because it's sort of confusing when you think about what the Antichrist is tied to, his rise and fall. And then they're still arguing about it.
It is very muddled, I would agree.
What's the basis for the Antichrist being from the tribe of Dan?
Verses from the Old Testament that talk about Dan being, a curse being on Dan and stuff like that. That's without going through every single verse, that's generally where that type of thinking is coming from. But my point here is this. This guy
is not inventing some new teaching. The teaching had been latent or dormant in certain areas of the church, even within the Catholic Church, for centuries before this guy shows up in the 1580s. Alright, let's go to the next point. Christopher Hill concurs with Norman Coe when he writes, "The Antichrist legend was summed up in the 10th century by French monk Adso, and taken over by Orthodox scholastics like Thomas Aquinas and Albertus Magnus. The identification of the Pope with the Antichrist by medieval heretics led to the assumption that Babylon must be Rome, where Joachim of Flora taught Antichrist had already been born. In general, the widespread adoption by respectable Protestant scholars of the view that the Pope was Antichrist led Roman Catholic interpreters to lay a new emphasis on Antichrist as a Jew, man of great erasion, like Ravenza and Alcuza, and so on. E.B. Eliot was a very learned and well-known writer of the historicist school of prophetic interpretation. In one of his works, he summarized the prophetical thought of Rivera. It is clear that his summary is presented with a hidden bias in favor of futurism. Rivera is not a futurist. His commentary on Revelation moves back and forth between historicist view and futurist view. Now, you need to look at these comments. Rivera has thought good to explicate the argument of the apocalypse as if it were nothing else but certain commentaries upon the Lord's prophecy in Matthew 24. He makes it begin with the early period of the church. So his first seal's white horse and rider signify the gospel's triumphs of the apostolic era. His third seal, black horse and rider, heresies. The fourth seal, the violence of Trajan's persecution on the church, and multiple deaths of Christians under it by sword, famine, and wild beasts, etc. Now, here's the point I want to get you to see. When this guy writes his commentary on Revelation, he says that seals 1 through 4, at least, all refer to stages in church history. I have a question for you. Is that futurist or historicist? That's historicist. Read on. At length, in the sixth year, Rivera explained the phenomena there figured as men of the signs before Christ's second coming spoken in Matthew 24 and Luke 21, and constructs the sealing vision too with all that follows in the apocalypse, to have reference to the times of the Antichrist. The 144,000 of Apocalypse, that'd be chapter 7, he makes to be Jews converted to Christ at the consummation, though inconsistently afterwards explains 144,000 in chapter 14 of both Jews and Gentiles under Antichrist, and taking the number 144,000 literally, four first trumpets he explains literally. The locusts of trumpet 5, however, he expounds figuratively of a woe of cruel and barbarous invading armies as barbarous as the Goths and Vandals of old, with their crowned kings leading them on against the church. In the millennium, Rivera follows Augustine. It is the whole time of Christ's resurrection to Antichrist's kingdom, the New Jerusalem being viewed by him, Parius seems to hint as a figure of the Church of Rome. Now, here's the point. Look at it here. As one can see from this excerpt, Rivera is far from a futurist. His explanation contains aspects of historicism, futurism, and Augustinian amillennialism. Early English futurist Charles Maitland stated the following when discussing Jesuit views on the Book of Revelation. In proportion as the life of the Reformation declined, Rome relaxed these efforts that enabled her to hold her ground in the great theological strife. The Jesuits, no longer thinking it needful to grant so much, shut up the apocalypse and devoted themselves to those political intrigues that have made their names infamous in modern history. Now the point is this. This guy, when you read his work, he is not a consistent one. Futurist. He goes back and forth in his interpretation of the Book of Revelation between historicism, futurism, and amillennialism. And he's about as confused and muddled as anybody can be in their interpretation of the Book of Revelation. So for somebody to say
that Rivera is the source of dispensational futurism and the pre-tribulation rapture is nothing more than an attempt to try to discredit Darby on purpose because you don't like what he says. You don't like his doctrine and you don't like his teaching. Because when you look at what this guy actually taught, the seal 1 through 4 being states in the history of church, then he says that seal number 7 is a summary of the entire tribulation. Then he waffles on the 144,000, whether they're Jews, whether they're Gentiles, when are they sealed, when are they not sealed. Then when it comes to the issue of the millennium, the thousand-year reign itself, he defaults to the amillennialism of Augustine. So he is all over the theological map, as it were, and he's not consistent ever in how he's approaching the book of Revelation if you read what he says. So all of these guys that want to attribute futurism to this genuine punk right here are not really being honest about what this guy actually said about the book of Revelation. Now, last point, and then we'll take any questions or comments here. To say that futurism is Jesuitism, as does L.R. Thomas, seems quite bitter. For such a student of history as H.G. Guinness to say that futurism was first invented by the Jesuit Rivera is utterly excuseless. Okay? Not only were there people before him teaching things similar like we just saw, but when you actually study what he writes, there's no way it's consistent with a futurist interpretation of the book of Revelation. It is all over the map. Okay? Now, any questions or comments about that point? No? Alright. And we'll go to the next point. Historicism in the two-stage pre-conflagration rapture. So what is that? Well,
you'll see in a minute. I am going to have to erase some of this in a minute so I can draw out something else on the board.
But Joseph Mead is the father of English historicism. It is quite clear that he held a two-stage coming. Now, what do we mean by two-stage? Two different aspects in the coming of Christ. Okay? He mistakenly thought that 2 Peter, here we go to 2 Peter, go to 2 Peter chapter 3.
So we're done with Rivera here.
Second Peter chapter 3, look at verse 10. The day of the Lord will come as a thief in the night, in the which the heavens shall pass away with a great noise, and the elements shall melt with fervent heat. And the earth also and the works therein shall be burned up. Okay, now go back to the notes. Joseph Mead is the father of English historicism. It is quite clear that he held a two-stage coming. He mistakenly thought that 2 Peter 3:10 applied to a premillennial conflagration to be followed by a renovation of the earth so as to be fit to dwell on for the millennium. Okay? So he says this. If this is the earth, he says that the burning of the earth by fire is going to occur before what? The millennium. And this is from 2 Peter 3, verse 10. Okay? And that this burning of the earth there is preparation for what? The millennium.
Let's read on.
This created the difficulty of what to do with the saints while the conflagration went on. The solution was to have Christ come in two stages, in the first of which the saints would be raptured, and then when the conflagration and renovation were completed, the Lord would descend to the earth with the saints. This influenced some of the subsequent writers, for Joseph Mead's works were read widely. So, he says that at the end of the tribulation, there's going to be a what? A rapture. The saints will be caught up, and I'll show you this in a minute, off of the earth.
right? To meet the Lord in the air, up here. While that is going on, the earth is destroyed by fire, what they call the conflagration. The earth is renovated back to a pristine condition. And then, what happens? The second coming. So you have a two-stage coming, right? Stage one would be that. Stage two would be what? Would be that. So stage one is a catching away to meet the Lord in the air, followed by the burning of the earth, what they call a conflagration, the renovation of the earth. And once the earth that is now is destroyed, and the new earth is there, then the Lord will do what? Return for a second coming back to earth and set up the millennial reign of Christ. Now let's go on. Joseph Meade, now look at the dates here, 1586 through 1638, lived long before July 1830. You say, why are you stressing that? You'll see in a minute. Mr. McPherson, that's Dave McPherson, the author of the Rapture Plot and other books, says July 1830 is the point at which he found the earliest mention of even a hint in Irving's writings of a two-stage coming. So McPherson, the big scholar, says, I could not find anywhere in the writings of church history before 1830 anybody talking about a two-stage coming. Well, on that point, because in the late 1600s, Joseph Meade is talking about that exact thing. Okay, let's read on. Joseph Meade lived long before 1830. Mr. McPherson says July 1830 is the point at which he found the earliest mention of even a hint in Irving's writings of a two-stage coming. Let us pause for a moment to ask, is that what this is about? Merely finding a mention of a two-stage coming? Yes, it is. And finding a two-stage coming is the basis of his claim of having found the origin of the pre-tribulation rapture in the utterance of Mary McDonald of Port Glasgow in 1830. What then does McPherson do with the following statement made by Joseph Meade in the early 1600s? Notice what he says. I will add this more, namely, what may be conceived to be the cause of this rapture of the saints on high to meet the Lord in the clouds, rather than to wait his coming to earth. Now, stop right there. Is Meade clearly saying that there's going to be an event where the Lord catches away the saints to meet him in the air? Yes. Read on. What if it be that they may be preserved during the conflagration of the earth and the works thereof, 2 Peter 3:10, that as Noah and his family were preserved from the deluge by being lifted up above the water in the ark, so should the saints at the conflagration be lifted up in the clouds unto their ark, Christ, to be preserved from the deluge of fire, where the wicked shall be what? Now that's about as plain as you can get, right? If he's saying that the saints are going to escape the deluge of fire and be caught up to meet the Lord in the air, followed by the renovation of the destruction of the current earth and the renovation of a new earth by fire. Is that what he's saying? Okay? Let's keep going. He's comparing it back to what happened with Noah.
Yeah.
Where did the tribulation... Let's keep going. Of course, there is a two-stage coming in that quotation, though McPherson will not have it be so. Moreover, there have been other historicists that taught in such terms. For McPherson to admit that there were some who held a two-stage coming before the time he alleges Margaret McDonald did would undo his 30-plus year mission and expose his litany of ad hominem attacks and calamities for what they really are. Implicit in holding a premillennial conflagration based on 2 Peter 3:10 is a historicist two-stage coming, with a pre-conflagration rapture and the return to the earth after the conflagration has passed and the earth has been renovated. So Meade is clearly teaching, again,
that there is going to be a catching away of the saints prior to this event right here that he puts before the millennium. Okay? It gets rid of everything, it cleanses the earth, it purifies the earth, so that when Christ returns here to set up the millennial reign, he's returning to a pristine earth in perfect condition. In other words, is what he's saying. Now, what McPherson is saying is that you cannot find anyone before the year 1830 teaching a two-stage coming. What does it mean, teaching? He's teaching a two-stage coming, isn't he? Increase Mather stated the following in a dissertation concerning the future conversion of the Jewish nation. The living saints at Christ's coming. Now look at the date, by the way. What's the date here? 1709 when he writes this. The living saints at Christ's coming shall be caught up into the air so they may escape the deluge of fire, which will be perdition of ungodly men. Luke, and then he gives some verses here. Luke 17:34, 1 Thessalonians 4, 2 Peter 3:7. But before this rapture of the living, the dead shall be raised. Therefore the apostle says, they that remain of the coming of the Lord shall not prevent them which are asleep, i.e., they as their bodies shall not be with Christ before the bodies of saints asleep in the grave shall be with them, but the dead in Christ shall rise first, and after that the living saints will be caught up to meet the Lord in the air, 1 Thessalonians 4:15, 16, etc. As when the flood came, there was a difference made between Noah's family and the rest of mankind. Thus when the world shall perish by fire, no saint shall be hurt by fire, but sinners shall. So again, now where do you suppose that guy learned that from? Where do you think Mather learned that from? In 1709. Maybe the Bible, but he probably, yes, he's clearly referring to the Bible, but I would suggest to you he learned it from me in the front, who wrote in the 1600s. Because he's essentially saying the exact same thing. Now, the following quotations are taken from Rainier Solminski, is how I would say it, The Threefold Paradise of Cotton Mather, an edition of Tripodorus, published posthumously, given Cotton Mather's, so this would be again 1663 to 1728, mature view on the subjects treated. Alright, so this is a random sampling here. So this is mature views on the subjects treated, one of which is the conflagration, to which much space is given based on viewing 2 Peter 3:10. Notice, here it is, as introductory to the what? So what is it that's going to usher in the millennial state on earth? It's going to be the conflagration of the earth, and they put this before the second coming. Okay, now let's keep going looking at the notes here. One of the last things that happen to the saints before Christ comes, and here it is the persecution by who? So the people that are on earth here are going to be persecuted by who? Antichrist. So there you go. That answers your question, Bart, that they clearly view this as being during what? The tribulation. Okay? Because who's on earth persecuting the saints? The Antichrist. Go on.
So what stage are they lifted into the air then after the mid or post?
We'll get to that. Okay. So one of the last things that happened to the saints before Christ comes is the persecution of the Antichrist. The saints shall be caught up to meet the Lord. Our God, having thus made up his jewels and snatched away all that he had any value for the earth, is now left with none but the wicked upon it. The vials of divine wrath are poured out upon the world. Now, why should it be thought that a thing incredible to you that God should bring upon the earth a conflagration which will at once carry all before it, since the world is as wicked now as it was before the flood?
and there will be a far greater number saved out of the conflagration than there were out of the inundation. The saved will be far, far more than 8 persons. 'Tis to be hoped that there will be no fewer than 144,000 of them for whom the new earth will be replenished. During this time of the saints, during this time the saints will be saved, caught up to the place where the Lord will have His holy ones with Him at such a distance from the earth as to deliver them from the wrath to come. And from the flames of the world on fire, they will be then again returned unto the field prepared unto them and be on the new earth. The Antichrist will perish during the conflagration. Now, I don't know about you, but that's pretty clear to me. So, Mark, I say that these guys are teaching that this happens sometime toward what? The end of the tribulation. The Antichrist is on earth. The Antichrist is destroyed here. That's what Matthew just said. Okay? Prior to that, the saints are lifted off to meet the Lord in the air, where they are held in safety away from the wrath of God being poured out during this conflagration. And once the earth is burned and renovated, then they will come back with the Lord at His second coming and enter into what? The millennium. Now, remember, McPherson says that the two-stage coming is not taught before the year what? Oh my goodness. We have Joseph Meek teaching it in the 1600s. We have, what's the other guy's name here? What's that? We got Cotton Mather teaching. We got all these guys teaching it. If you look at the bottom of page 5, other historicist writers that held to some form of a pre-conflagration two-stage coming include the following. John Gill, 1697 to 1771, wrote a body of doctrine, the practical divinity. Thomas Burnett, 1635 to 1750, published the sacred theory of the earth, continuing an account of the original earth and all of the general changes which it already hath undergone or is to undergo till the consummation of all things, and that was published in 1719.
Were these all generally available, or were they scattered in different cities and different? I mean, where were they kept at that time?
Well, when Huebner writes the book that I'm one of the main books I'm using here, he's published in 2004, the second edition.
Oh, so he's arguing these points, but he's got all.
But his point is, look, McPherson is so hell bent on making Darby a liar that he's not even being honest with the facts.
Okay, well, he's contemporary to God.
Yeah. Okay. To my knowledge, McPherson is still alive, and he's wrote a whole series of books again. You know, how he calls himself the world's leading expert on the rapture.
Okay.
But the point here is this. He says that though he can't find anywhere before 1830 a two-stage coming. I guess if you want to be technical, he says in the writings here, because we're going to see in a minute where he actually does fudge and hedge a little bit, and it's fascinating to see what he actually admits when he does hedge his bets against some of the new material, because see, what's happening here is a scholarly argument amongst one guy, Huebner, who believes that Darby's telling the truth, and McPherson, who's hell-bent to prove that he's wrong. And as Huebner's doing research and putting things out there, McPherson is forced to respond to some of it. And others. I mean, Huebner's not the only guy doing this. Now, in the writings, top of page 6, in the writings of the Calvinist Baptist Morgan Edwards, we have a historicist who taught that the rapture would occur before the 1260 days, i.e. a mid-tribulation rapture. This is further evidence, despite McPherson's claim to the contrary, that people were teaching a two-stage coming before Margaret MacDonald of Fort Glasgow in her supposed revelation received in 1830. Let us consider Morgan Edwards in his own words before looking at McPherson's dismissal of the evidence. In two academical exercises on subjects bearing the following titles, Millennium Last Novelties, published by Dobson and Lang in 1788, we find the following words of Morgan Edwards. Okay? Number two, this is point number two in his book. The distance between the first and second resurrection will be somewhat more than 1,000 years. I say somewhat more because the dead saints will be raised and the living changed at Christ's appearing in the air. And this will be about three years and a half before the millennium. So what is he saying?
He's saying, so this up here, this would be, what's the guy's name? I just said it three times. This would be need. This would be matter. And others. What Edwards is saying, if this is the tribulation, 7th week of Daniel, that the rapture of the saints is going to occur before 1260 days, or the last 3.5 what?
Years.
Years. So that would be then a mid-trib view. So let's read on through the notes here.
I say somewhat more because the dead saints will be raised, and the living change of Christ appearing in the air, 2 Thessalonians 4:17, and this will be about 3.5 years before the what? The millennium. As we shall see hereafter, but he will then abide in the air all that time. No, they will ascend to paradise or to some one of those many mansions in the Father's house of God. And to disappearing during the foresaid period of time, the design of this retreat and disappearing will be to judge the risen and changed states. For now this time has come, the judgment must begin, and that will be at the house of God. So
it's kind of a little bit confusing, but what he's saying essentially is that when does the catching away of the saints occur? Mid-trib, before the 1260 days, or before, or 3.5 years before the millennium. And then they're going to be taken back into the Father's house and all that sort of thing, okay? According to what Edwards is saying.
Look at the next point. He appears in the air with a shout. Blessed is he that come in the name of the Lord. The other witnesses visit John, will preach to the Gentiles, for people, nations, and tongues, and kings are applicable to none but them. When these witnesses will appear, it is hard to say, for through their time of prophesying in sackcloth is 1260 days, or 3 years and a half, allowing 30 days to a month. Yet they may preach out of sackcloth long before, for the 1260 days rest only on the time that the holy city and the outer court of the temple shall be trodden underfoot of the Gentiles, or Antichrist and his army, this up 42 months, which make exactly 1260 days, allowing 22 a month, but the ministry of the witnesses requires many, many more years to perform the time, of their wearing sackcloth and so on and so forth. Look at the next point. The struggling of Antichrist towards the mastery of the world and his assumption of the Godhead will also precede the millennium. Who this Antichrist will be is hard to say. I take him for the last of them who have plagued the world under the names of popes. The Antichrist is to be destroyed at Christ's coming to reign. Another event previous to the millennium will be the appearing of the Son of Man in the clouds to raise the dead saints and change the living, to catch them up to himself, and then withdrawing them as observed before. This event will come to pass when Antichrist be arrived at Jerusalem in his conquest of the world.
And again, he says, that happens when? Before the 1260 days, because Jerusalem is going to be trodden down to Gentiles, how long?
1260 days.
So Edwards is teaching a mid-tribulation rapture of the saints in the year, what was the date on this book again? In the year 1788. Let's read, finish the notes at the top of page 7. Another event previous to the millennium will be the appearing of the Son of Man in the clouds, coming to raise the dead saints and change the living, and to catch them up to himself and then withdrawing them. And observe before, this event will come to pass when the Antichrist be arrived in Jerusalem in his conquest of the world, about 3.5 years before the killing of the witnesses and the assumption of Godhead. The last event, the event that will usher in the millennium, will be the coming of Christ from paradise to earth with all the saints he had taken up thither about 3.5 years. What? So folks, so all these people that he took to the Father's house, sorry, these are kind of running into each other, he's going to bring with them where? Back to earth at the second coming, and he said that they were taken up 1260 days. What? Prior. Is that a two-stage coming? But that's not supposed to exist according to who? McPherson. Next point. We're probably going to finish this point and then stop. Evening reports the following regarding McPherson's view of Morgan Edwards. McPherson's view must necessarily be predetermined by insisting on maintaining that he discovered the source of the pre-tribulation rapture, i.e. in Margaret MacDonald of Port Glasgow in 1830. Apparently he is incapable of seeing a 1260-day rapture, or mid-trib, and the subsequent appearing of Christ as presented in Morgan Edwards. In the rapture plot, McPherson makes the following statement about the pre-1260-days rapture articulated by Edwards. Edwards' scheme of a rapture 3.5 years before the end of a 1260-year tribulation has the same tiny gap of a futurist would have if he were to teach a rapture 3.5 days before the end of the 1260-day tribulation. Since such a futurist view would be seen as a post-trib view, Edwards must be classified as a historicist post-trib. I say the same thing. What? Because he's not... We just read the quotes from Edwards, right? I got him. I found him in his own words, okay? He's saying that the Lord is going to return with the saints that he caught away 1260 days what?
Before.
So I don't know what in the world McPherson is talking about. Look at the next point. Huebner correctly points out the following implicit admission on the part of McPherson. Even so, that would be an historicist post-trib holding a two-stage coming. So understand what McPherson is trying to do. He's trying to close the gap here and make it only a short time between when the saints are taken away according to Edwards and when they return. And he's doing it by trying to say that he was teaching a post-trib view. But in doing so, what is he admitting? He's admitting that he's teaching a two-stage what? Coming. That wasn't supposed to have been taught until when? You guys following that? So let's finish the quote here. Even so, that would be an historicist post-trib holding a two-stage coming. So after all, even with his humbug explaining away the plain fact that Morgan Edwards viewed the 1260 days as days, not years, he ends with the implicit admission of a two-stage coming, trying to minimize the thrust of this by referring to a tiny gap of 3.5 days. It sounds like a biased claim game is at work, not sobriety in investigation. Can such a person be trusted to tell us what the writings quoted above? Let me start over that sentence. Can such a person be trusted to tell us what the writers quoted above thought, or what Mary MacDonald thought, or what John Nelson Darby thought? What's he trying to do there? He's trying to point out to you that McPherson is what? He is unreliable and he is untrustworthy, and his hatred for the doctrine of the pre-tribulation rapture has led him to claim things that further research into the issue should have led any honest scholar to detract. Okay? So, a couple things I want you to see before we see if there are any questions here. Number one, were there people before Darby who understood a difference between 1 Thessalonians 4 and Revelation 19? Between the meeting of the Lord in the air and his second coming bodily back to earth? Yes, okay? And they tried to explain where that fit. Meade, Mather, and others of the historicist group put it at the end of the tribulation, before the conflagration of the earth, according to 1 Peter chapter 3, verse 10, and the renovation of the earth, followed by the second coming of Christ to set up the millennium. Morgan Edward, the Baptist historicist, said that it happened when? Mid-trib, or pre-1260 days, or 3.5 years before the second coming. Now, you see a trend here? The first view put it where? As the history of the doctrine of the rapture unfolded, or is recovered, or is experienced a resurgency, they first identify it as happening where? The next generation backs it up and says it happens where? Darby's generation is going to back it up and say it happens where? Because what is Darby going to see that Edwards, Mather, Meade, and others didn't see? He sees a clear distinction between Israel and the church. And once he understands that, and the body of Christ is being seated with the Lord in heaven, he understands that the only thing that has to happen is for the Lord to come and catch away his saints to meet him where? In the air. I'm going to suggest to you that Darby does not invent anything. What Darby is doing is accurately placing an event in the biblical chronology that men before him were struggling to identify, and because they didn't see the distinction between Israel and the church and dispensational truth, they ended up putting it in the wrong place. Okay? Any questions or comments about any of that?
We will stop at the bottom of page 7 on Manuel de Lacunza and whether or not he was the source of the pre-tribulation rapture. And we'll pick that up in 2 weeks because we are not having class on New Year's Day. Ronnie?
Without imputing motives to any of these people except for McPherson, I am just kind of thinking that all through the centuries, including the Jesuit scholars, people have simply been trying to figure out what's the timeline here, how do the verses fit together.
To some degree, I agree with you, and this has actually changed somewhat the way I've thought about this. Because anybody that can read 1 Thessalonians 4, and where it talks about us meeting the Lord in the air, and know that they cannot be the same as Revelation 19. Well, then if they're not the same, what's the next question? The next question would be, how do they fit together, or when do they happen, and how are they different? Okay? And so you have men here struggling to explain it, but what's the piece? What's the missing ingredient? The thing that they don't get. The thing that they're not focusing on or not getting is the application of dispensational truth to the subject. And that's where, when Darby understands the distinction between Israel and the church being heavenly and Israel being the earthly people of God and so forth, then he's able to identify properly. And he recognizes that Matthew 24 is written about the nation of Israel, by and large. He understands that there's a difference between these events, and then he's able to put it in the right spot.
Is there any indication how long that conflagration takes place?
Yeah, that's a good question. No, none of the stuff I read, they don't explain how long they think it's going
to
be.
Yeah,
the earth is renovated, this earth is destroyed by fire, and then a pristine new earth is presented
for the Lord to return onto for the millennium. Okay? So, First, Rivera. It is a fallacious claim that Rivera invented futurism. There were people before Rivera teaching elements and aspects of futurism. And not only that, when you study Rivera, he's not even consistent. He is all over the theological map. He adapts pieces of historicism, pieces of futurism, and pieces of amillennialism. Okay? And then number two, the second thing we saw is that there were people teaching a two-stage coming before 1830 when Dave McPherson says, Darby says the teaching originated from this tongue-speaking girl in Port Glasgow, Scotland in 1830. All right, any other questions or comments? Yeah. Any questions or comments? So let me just reiterate, we are not meeting next Sunday morning. We will be meeting the following Sunday, and we'll be picking it up with where we're leaving off here on the bottom of page 7. Okay? Any questions or comments? All right, hopefully this is beneficial to you, and thanks for coming.